Hello, everybody. Welcome to the bonus episode for you, our beloved Wangs and Athelstans. And normally, it would obviously be me and Dominic. And this time around, it was going to be Dominic and Theo, because I am actually on holiday in Cornwall this week. But British air traffic control has intervened because there's been some spectacular meltdown with software or something, which means that all flights have basically been cancelled. And Dominic is with his wife, Catherine, and Arthur in Ireland, where Catherine comes from. And so he's stuck there, stranded without his recording equipment. And so, ever devoted as I am to the podcast, I have abandoned the beach and come to the microphone to join Theo, who is back in London. So hi, Theo. Morning.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you at 5 a.m. on the Tuesday morning. Of course not. It's definitely not 5 a.m. Hi, everyone. Athelstans and Wangs. Great to be here again. You can't get enough of me by now, I'm sure. Dominic, again, not laying the side down. We'll blame the air traffic control.
No, he was very keen. I'm not going to...
I was really keen to do the bonus with him. I was, you know...
I know, you're bored of me, aren't you?
We've had our fun. But war talked out, I think.
So I thought that because I'm on holiday and because I don't have Dominic, and because I know everyone loves to hear what people do on the holidays, I could just mention some of the things that I've been reading over the course of this summer.
Definitely.
Because actually, the hot news is that I know that I said I never read novels. That's not absolutely true. I do read novels on holiday.
Spy thrillers.
Yes, so I've been reading Mick Herron's spy thrillers. So those who haven't read Mick Herron, he's a British spy thriller writer, the heir of Le Carré, but he's also exceedingly funny, much funnier than Le Carré was. And the premise of his books is that there is the British Secret Service, and then there's a kind of a dumping zone for failed spies called Slough House, which is everyone's worst nightmare of an office. Commanded by this kind of Dickensian grotesque, who's one of the great comic figures in contemporary British literature. And Slough House, of course, is a kind of metaphor for Britain. And it's very much the kind of place where air traffic control would melt down and collapse. So I've enjoyed them very much. And I have been reading Patrick O'Brien. And the reason I wanted to start with Patrick O'Brien is that obviously this is our podcast. And so we tend to be the ones who get asked for the reading recommendations. People often on the Discord will say, you know, are there any particular books you can recommend on this subject or that subject? But with Patrick O'Brien, I have returned to it because of you, the listeners, the vast kind of overwhelming majority of you telling me that my objections to Patrick O'Brien were erroneous.
What would you do without the listeners guiding your literary choices?
What would I do without them? What would I do without them? And basically saying that I had to conquer my animus against rope and mizzen masts and whatever kind of sails and all that
sails.
Kind of stuff, triangular sails, all that kind of stuff. And anyway, I'm completely hooked. I found the first novel, I'm sure I mentioned this before, but yeah, just to reiterate, I found the first novel quite a struggle, but I butched it out. Mm-hmm. I kind of forced myself through. Second one, quite a kind of Jane Austen vibe to it. There's quite a lot going on land involving kind of dancers and mothers-in-law and all that kind of thing. And I enjoyed that more. But I read the next two, one of which our two heroes go to India. And then I've just finished the fourth one, which involves a war around Mauritius.
Can't get enough of it.
Absolutely addicted. Have you read them?
No, I never have. I mean, now I feel like...
You've been left behind.
Kind of. I mean, I would also never read something with kind of ropes and sails and boats and all that. It's not really my cup of tea.
I agree. Me too. I was half persuaded by doing the Nelson stuff for Trafalgar, which I really, really enjoyed, much to my surprise.
It seems like a proper laddish kind of way to spend your life, of going out and sea with the lads.
But the interesting thing is I've got lots of female friends who have recommended it as well. I've got an American friend who's a kind of Bostonian, very Henry James, very, you know, Edith Wharton, who is absolutely obsessed by them. So I don't think it is just a male thing. I mean, all the guns and stuff, of course it is, but the writing is very, very funny. And as lots of people on the Discord have said who love Patrick O'Brien, all that stuff about masts and ropes is kind of the tech equivalent of the stuff that you get in Star Trek or something like that. You just have to let it wash over you.
Okay.
And enjoy the portraits of friendship, of marital love, the wonderful descriptions of animals. And as I say, again and again, it's actually very funny. So just to thank everyone who has recommended it to me, I've really enjoyed that. And I have read some history. So I read a wonderful new history of the Middle Ages called Beatrice's Last Smile. And Beatrice as in Dante, the beloved of Dante in the Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
And that's written by Mark Gregory Pegg, who listeners may remember I cited his work on the Albigensians in the episodes we did on the Albigensian Crusades. And he's a kind of brilliant revisionist writer on that, who has really completely reconfigured the historical understanding of who the Albigensians were and whether such an order of people as Cathars actually existed. And he says he doesn't. And he has brought his kind of searching analysis of the sources. He's an immensely stylish writer as well to the entire sweep of the Middle Ages. Although his definition of the Middle Ages is quite interesting because it actually begins early in the 3rd century AD.
Third century AD?
Yes. Wow. And it ends with Joan of Arc.
Wow. So starts early, finishes early. How does he justify that?
I think it's fair to say it's much more of a me kind of history than a Dominic one. So there's not much on the material circumstances in the Middle Ages.
Sure.
But there is quite a lot about the way in which people's understanding of what it is to be human, what it is to have a relationship with God, what that means for the way that society is structured, how that has evolved and changed from the Roman period up to the 15th century. And it's really, really enjoyable book. Wonderfully, wonderfully enjoyable book to read. So I recommend that.
So there must be something there about, I mean, for you, it must be a great read because it traces the start of the transformation from kind of the Roman deities and Roman world to a more Christian dominion.
Yes, it is. And I guess that the obvious comparison is with Peter Brown, who I'm sure lots of listeners will have heard of and read, but he is probably the greatest living historian writing in English. And when I say living, I mean, I think he's in his 90s.
Better than Dominic.
They're kind of rivaling each other for the top spot.
Sure.
But he is, I mean, he effectively evolved an entire new understanding of the chronology of the past. So, you know, there was antiquity and then the Middle Ages. This is the way that history is divided up.
Mm.
And he constituted this chronological marker that he came to call late antiquity, which is the period of transformation from the ancient to the medieval. And he wrote a wonderful history of how Western Europe became Christian, that inevitably, because the history of Western Christendom derives from the entire history of how the Roman Empire and even beyond became Christian, it includes a lot about the Near East, about the rise of Islam and so on. But it kind of ends up focused on Western Europe and ends, I think, around the first millennium. But Pegg's book goes right the way up, as I say, to the 15th century. So it's like a kind of riff on Peter Brown that is even longer.
Cool.
So I commend that to everyone. And the other thing I did, have I mentioned this before? I don't think I have. Actually, no, I haven't, because we've just been doing questions, haven't I, with Dominic? But I was up in the Northeast, so near Lindisfarne, Holy Island, the island off the Northumbrian coast, the monastic settlement founded by the Irish saint, St. Aidan, and St. Cuthbert, my great saintly hero.
Friend of the show.
Became bishop there and died on the Farne Islands, which are even remoter than Lindisfarne, being ascetic. And then, of course, it notoriously got sacked by the Vikings and put to the torch. So it's a wonderful, wonderfully haunting and atmospheric place. But there is an official national trail called St. Cuthbert's Way, which goes from Melrose, which is an amazing place in Scotland, your native land, Theo.
Well, there's a statue there of, isn't there a big statue in Melrose?
There's an enormous statue of William Wallace.
That's it, yeah.
On a hill above Melrose.
Yep. They have a sevens tournament in Easter most years that you probably won't know about, but the local Edinburgh youths decant into Melrose to have a drink and not watch some rugby sevens.
I don't know about that, Theo. But what I do know, it was a Roman fort. King Arthur is buried beneath a hill that looms above it.
Mm-hmm.
And germanely from the point of view of St. Cuthbert, there was an abbey where he became a novice. There's a description of him riding up on his horse with his spear and casting them aside and becoming a monk there. So you go from Melrose, which is about 70 miles from Lindisfarne, mm-hmm. and you follow the line of the Tweed, and you go up through kind of various hills and over mountains and things, and all very atmospheric. So I did that as well.
Charming.
So that's what I've mostly been doing this summer. And I know that what people do in the summer is very boring, but what the hell?
No, well, you have such interesting holidays, Tom, and the people...
Oh, but I haven't. I haven't, because Dominic's been very sneery about this, because he's saying, "What, you know, why am I staying in Britain?"
That's not bad-mouth him. He's going to listen back to this and think, why is Tom, again, slagging me off in the bonus?
I never slag Dominic off.
Of course, I never slag him off.
I mean, I dread to think what he would have been saying had the air traffic controllers not intervened.
We'll never know, Tom. To hark back quickly to Master and Commander, so the movie is Russell Crowe, is it not?
Yes. And
Paul Bettany.
Paul Bettany.
So we might have a plan, I think, to do some sort of Russell Crowe week next year. A very loose plan, which has not been properly vetted.
Yes.
But it was to do most of his historical movies, I guess, in a week.
Gladiator and Master and Commander, I guess.
Robin Hood?
No, not Robin Hood.
Not a fan?
It's a very dull film.
It is.
And he had a terrible kind of accent, didn't he?
Yes.
It was a kind of Aussie, Yorkshire, West Country accent. Mm. And I know that I'm not one to criticise people's accents, but...
Well, we're there already.
You know, so. He's a trained actor, so he should be better than that. He got an enormous strop with an interviewer who criticised his accent and stormed off set. So I don't think we'd do Robin Hood, but we don't need... You know, his performances in Gladiator and Master and Commander are so superb that I think we could focus on them. Should we talk through what we've got coming up? I mean, so the live shows, we've got Hammersmith Apollo in London at the end of October.
And then our adventure begins, or our unexpected journey.
Down under.
To New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah, so we're very much looking forward to that. So that we've got that lined up. And we also have lots of episodes that we'll be doing when we all get back. So when Dominic gets back from Ireland and when I get back from Cornwall, we will be kicking off on Monday, won't we, with the real Harry Potter and the real Hogwarts, which are excellent titles, disguising the fact that basically they're going to be enabling Dominic to talk about private schools, which is he's been wanting to do right from the very beginning. And we finally agreed that he can do it. And it is, I think, will be a really, really interesting topic, particularly the story of private schools in Britain. It's amazing. In the 18th century, it involves the local militia having to come and fire cannon on rioting schoolboys and things. So all kinds of beatings and hideous stuff.
A lot to look forward to there.
Yeah.
I will ask you before we do questions, any thoughts on the recent episodes? Taj Mahal, Library of Alexandria, 60s, both episodes came out yesterday.
I haven't listened to the 60s ones yet. So we're saving them because we've got to drive back from Cornwall.
I can reassure you they're very good.
Well,
very good.
So these are episodes that will be of interest to my younger daughter, Eliza, who does, you know, she loves her fashion and she's very into the 60s. So we're going to save them up and listen to them. Quite excited to hear how good my singing is. I remember it being absolutely...
It's brilliant. Like,
top
it is
notch.
Up there. I thought it was Ray Davies singing.
You're very kind. And actually, Theo, on the subject of 60s and podcasts, when we were driving down to Cornwall, we listened to three episodes that I'd been saving up of a Beatles podcast called Nothing Is Real, which is, am I allowed to say it's brilliant? It's really great.
As long as you listen to our episodes first, listeners, we don't mind if you listen to the Beatles podcast.
Obviously, but two wonderfully funny and knowledgeable presenters who, I mean, when they do deep dives, they go really deep. Mm. And this was on, this was called The Making of Hey Jude. So it's about a single song.
Wow.
And in total, it comes to about 3 hours, 45 minutes, three episodes. And they go into every conceivable detail about how John leaves Cynthia, how he gets off with Yoko and all this kind of thing. But I was listening to it and thinking it's very kind of source-based criticism. They go through and they compare all the various accounts that the various protagonists have given over the course of their lives about, say, how John happened to leave Cynthia and end up with Yoko. And it's exactly like reading, you know, accounts of how the First Crusade broke out, or detailed accounts of the end of Mary, Queen of Scots or something. And you realize that, you know, there's nothing that is proof against this very close historical analysis. So highly recommend, if you have any interest in the Beatles, Nothing Is Real is a wonderful podcast.
As good as the Disney Plus show that came out last year, was it?
Oh, Christmas? The Get Back one?
Yeah.
It's the same kind of vibe. it's definitely one for those who
proper fans.
Proper fans, exactly. I mean, I think Nothing Is Real did podcasts on that were even longer than the actual film. I mean, it's very much that kind of thing.
Hmm. Deep dives, we're here for it.
A big contrast to our podcast on the French Revolution.
Yeah, famously, which we will set correct.
Yes. As we keep saying. So we've now got to do it. I mean, I think we've promised that so many times that there's now no way that we can row back on that.
Now that Viking Sorcerer has been put out, we don't have anything to, any episodes to hide behind.
Well, we do. We've got Eduard Habsburg on the Habsburgs. So when did we record that? I think in July.
It was in August.
No, it wasn't. It was in July.
Time has blurred this summer for me, Tom.
Because I realised, looking at the schedule, that we haven't put that in. So we need to schedule that.
Eduard, if you're listening, you'll be coming out very soon. Keep an element of suspense around that.
Because in a way, becoming the new Viking Sorcery, I mean, it just kind of builds up the expectation, doesn't it? And people were happy with Viking Sorcery. I think they felt that it was worth the wait.
I think Viking Sorcery was brilliant.
And I see you've drawn up a list of questions, and I'm just going to bend down and pick it up. So I'm going to leave the microphone. Hold on.
Go ahead.
So this is from Lee Spocht, and I don't know when he left it. But I've been listening to the Viking Sorcery episode, and I just wanted to tell you, I'm Sami, and it was really exciting to me to hear a shout out to us, no matter how small. We never get mentioned in history. I know we are a complicated people, but the bits you referenced were super on point. So thank you. So that is wonderful. So yeah. The Sami are the people who live right to the north of Scandinavia, and their kind of experiences of shamanism, Neil Price argues, were strong influence on how the Vikings understood sorcery. And actually, the Sami have a really crucial role to play in his book, The Viking Way, which we referenced in that. So thrilled to hear that we pass muster on that.
Yep. And we've got Bill Baker, who also wrote in to say, thank you for such entertaining stories from history. You are truly the Stephen Hawking and Jeremy Clarkson of history.
So presumably Dominic is the Stephen Hawking and I'm
yep,
Jeremy Clarkson.
Jeremy Clarkson.
Yeah.
Yeah, most likely. Questions. Should I throw a few questions at you, Tom, see what sticks?
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad about doing questions when Dominic's not here. You know, because it is a very kind of Lennon-McCartney thing, and we don't want to get in the habit of just doing our own thing.
Well, there's one here that Dominic will be really sad to miss out on, but it's from Lambert Simnel Kate. At Tom Holland, between the destruction of Carthage and the siege of Jerusalem, so 200 years or so, is there evidence that the Roman army evolved significantly in both weapons and tactics?
Yes, absolutely. There was a complete military revolution. So the army that destroys Carthage in 146 BC, and indeed the Greek city of Corinth, it's very much the kind of the levy-based system. It's recognizably the citizen army in the field that goes back to the beginnings of the Republic. And the organization of the army reflects the differences in class that enable the wealthier citizens to afford better armor than the poor, who kind of operate a role more akin to skirmishers. Between that and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, you have this revolution whereby the legio, the legion, the levy, becomes a professionalized army in which the legionaries are furnished with armor and constitute a professional organization. And because they're professional, because these are soldiers who are not serving brief periods of time and then going back to civilian life, but are enrolled for many, many years in the army, they can become much more effective. And so military tactics can become more efficient. And the level of armor, the level of weaponry is standardized. And I think that it is very easy for us, because we're habituated to the idea of something called the Roman army, to forget just how strange this is in the context of everything that had gone before. There isn't really a Roman army. There are just lots of different legiones, legions, Roman armies, if you want to put it that way. But they are professional, and they correspond, I suppose, to kind of state armies that we have now. And because of that, we don't recognize how odd it is that they had this in so long ago. And when the Roman Empire collapses and that professional model of an army goes, nothing really like it will be seen for many, many centuries. The Roman army, as it emerges over the final century of the Republic and into the early decades of the Empire, is a really, really astonishing institution. But a bit like the Roman Empire itself, it can take an effort of will to appreciate just how weird it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're kind of used to both. We think of there just being a Roman army, but it's such an odd institution. But the parallel between Carthage and Jerusalem is very on point, because that is the measure of
the destruction that they inflict on both places.
Yeah, there was no famous city was obliterated to quite the degree that Jerusalem was since Carthage.
Mm.
So, yeah, amazing.
Well, that does make me think, Tom, there might be an episode or two to do on, you know, how the Roman army changed throughout the centuries.
Well, I'd love to do that. Of course. I would absolutely love to do that.
Is that not sexy?
I think the Roman army is sexy.
Roman armies, the mystery.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very weird institution.
Yeah.
A very weird institution. And it's fascinating, even if you're not particularly interested in military history, which, I have to say, military history isn't the aspect of history that I particularly love. But a bit as with the Navy in the Age of Nelson, they are interesting as expressions of the society that produced them. And when you stop to take them for granted and you say, well, how did they come into existence? What kind of ideologies, what kind of assumptions, what kind of material basis exist for these very, very strange institutions? Because, of course, armies, like every other expression of societies, are culturally determined. So, yeah, I think that would be a very interesting topic. So can we add that to the list?
To the ever-growing list, yeah, sure. Coming to you very soon in late 2024. Okay, I don't think that any of these other questions are, you know, as Holland-centric as that one. But there is a final one from perennial friend of the show, Stephen Clark. Do you consider yourselves to be celebrities now? How much guidance do you get with public relations, etc., that you didn't get when you started doing the rest of history? So now when I go on tour with Tom and Dominic, I always bring bulletproof vests just in case. Tom, are you a celebrity?
I remember Eliza, my younger daughter, telling me ages ago that the definition of a celebrity was someone who had over 250,000 followers on a social media platform. And I have 300,000 followers on Twitter or X or Musk or whatever it's called these days. So I reckon that makes me a celebrity, but Dominic obviously isn't. So
no, that's an awkward one. Again, when he listens back, he won't be happy.
I don't think he would, because he despises social media. So I think he would regard it as a marker of my lack of seriousness and his kind of rugged John Bull refusal to truckle.
Your obsession with fame. Yeah,
exactly. What I will say is that considering podcasts are, you know, obviously you don't get seen on them. It's not like being on TV. I have noticed that I get stopped more often than I have done in the past by people who are often Wangs or Athelstans. And it's always an absolute pleasure to speak to them. And that, I guess, must reflect the degree to which the podcast is reaching people. But I don't think that podcasters are celebrities unless they're celebrities beforehand, like Alistair Campbell or Rory Stewart or Gary Lineker, to pluck a few names at random.
Well, TV's Tom Holland, surely.
I was never on TV enough to count as that.
Yeah, well, I've recommended your TV shows on Islam to a few friends recently.
Oh, thanks. Thank you very much. That's very kind.
They're ready to be radicalized by your Christian views. No, I take it back. I can see your face and you're thinking, what do I say to this? Did you not want to say a few words about PAX before we go?
Thank you, Theo. Yes, I do. Because I just should say that even though I'm on holiday, that hasn't stopped my wonderful but faintly terrifying American editor from bollocking me. Not doing enough to flog PAX, which anyone I'm sure who's listened to this will be astonished to learn that I haven't been doing enough.
I can't believe it.
But apparently I haven't been doing enough. So this is a message for American followers. I'm so sorry to be doing this. I know the whole point of being a Wang or an Athelstan is you don't have to put up with adverts, but just, you know, you can already cut off. This is going to be the last thing. So if you don't want to listen to it, but if you want to go to basicbooks.com/PAX and you type in PAX 20, you get a 20% discount off and you can pre-order it there. So I'm doing my duty by my wonderful American editor by that.
There's only a few copies left, right, Tom?
That's absolutely right. But you know, the stereotype that one might have that Americans are keener, I think, on the hard sell than the British.
Mm.
It is absolutely true with my experience of the respective approaches of my American and British editors. So
yeah,
the American editor is much readier to crack the whip. So I am jumping to the whip.
I really enjoy all the emails I get from both your publishers.
I know you do. I know you do, Theo. I know you do.
I really do. So we have to look forward to for the upcoming week. Obviously, everyone's binged both 60s Fashions episodes already. But then we have Marquis de Sade, Tom, our friend Le Marquis.
Le Marquis de Sade, yes.
Yeah.
And I just to say, I don't think we will be putting a trigger warning on that, will we? Because although there is quite a shocking opening passage that, as it were, that Dominic reads, yeah. Actually, there really is very little that is particularly unsettling or disturbing about it, because actually it's about the Enlightenment, it's about the French Revolution, it's about the paradoxes of liberty in a revolutionary age. I think it's a really interesting topic, and the Marquis de Sade is a fascinating figure. So I hope you enjoy that. And then we have Rana Mitter, the great historian of modern China, who will be coming on to talk about how China opened up to the world in the wake of Mao's death. So that is The Rise of Power of Deng Xiaoping, Tiananmen Square, and Theo, Wham! Mm-hmm. So Wham! Were the first Western group to go on tour.
Love Wham!
There's a wonderful documentary about them on Netflix, which we watched a couple of nights ago. So George Michael, of course, is the great star, but he did it with his childhood friend, Andrew Ridgeley, who was always kind of slightly laughed at, yeah, for being, you know, coasting
not
along.
Not George Michael.
And not, yeah, really doing it. But the documentary is great because it makes you realize how important Andrew Ridgeley was. And we discovered that Andrew Ridgeley lives not 6 miles from where we are. He's on a farmhouse outside Wadebridge.
Oh, brilliant.
And is sometimes to be seen in the Wadebridge Co-op. So we went and did our shop in the Wadebridge Co-op to see if we could spot him, but we didn't. But we may go back. So Deng Xiaoping, Tiananmen Square, and Wham! That will be coming up Thursday week. So we hope you enjoy that.
George Michael, friend of the show. While Dominic isn't here, I'll just give him that badge of honor already. Love George Michael.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. Okay, everyone. Well, I think that's all we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. Tom, thank you so much for saving the day and taking time off your holiday to serenade the Wangs.
Pleasure. So I'll be back home next week, and Dominic will hopefully be back from Ireland. So we will almost certainly be pairing up again next week, and we'll be going through more of your questions then. So bye-bye.
Bye-bye.